You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good morning. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to play an interview that I recorded last week that is really awesome, so I thought it needed to go out on the air. And before that, just a little news. You may or may not know, if you're a regular listener to the station, that this is KYRS's 10-year anniversary. I guess it's 10th birthday. So a little project that we are working on. Sam is a new programmer doing a show called Nonprofit Spokane. He had this great idea that we're going to get some birthday cards from people. So if you care about the station, if you're, you know, if you listen to KYRS, if you listen to this show specifically, and you want to send my show a birthday card for KYRS's 10th birthday, and I guess during the same month, Praxis will be turning 1.5 years old, so that's also exciting for us. So if you want to send in a birthday card, do, and you can send those to 35 West Main, address it to KYRS, and it will make it up here. So 35 West Main, Spokane, Washington, 99201. You can also look online at the Facebook page for KYRS or on the website at kyrs.org to find out that information. So just a quick birthday plug, but just a little introduction for this show. This last weekend and continuing through this week, the man who I interviewed first, who you'll hear first, Howard Vligger, he is from Iowa. He is a third generation farmer from Iowa, but he's also become a big-time activist and educator around the issue of GMOs, genetically modified, he doesn't like to call it food, food products that have been genetically modified. And he will bust a lot of myths in this interview, talk a lot about misconceptions about GMOs, some of the problems, mainly that the science that is used to justify the fact that they're, the presumption that they're not harmful is done by the industry itself. The problems with that, with having self-policing industries, you know, just trust us. We would never poison you. So he'll talk about that. And then Ron Culley is the other person who's interviewed in here, and he is working with the I-522 campaign. You may have seen some of their posters and stuff up. They're campaigning to do GMO labeling in the state of Washington, and he'll talk about a lot of the myths that you're likely to hear from the well-funded opposition to this campaign, which, surprise, surprise, is made up basically only of the five major chemical companies in the U.S. Lots of outside funding coming in to try to smack this initiative down. So both of those are happening. Hopefully, if you heard the word early enough, you may have been able to see Howard speak and give his presentation in person this last Saturday, a couple days ago, up on the Moran Prairie. I hope a lot of people were able to make it to that. They're continuing their way through Washington now, so you'll hear those remaining dates if you want to take a little road trip and meet them in person. And sometimes I forget what a bubble I've created for myself through social media and, you know, only interacting with interesting, intelligent people as much as possible. And I forget that there's a lot of people who have no idea when you say GMO, they don't know what you mean. I was working at an event this weekend, and a friend of mine makes jewelry that's centered around the F word that I can't say on the air. And she has one that says F GMOs. And a woman came by and she said she wanted to know if that had something to do with like gay culture or and if she should get it for her daughter who's a lesbian. And I said, no, it's about food. And I tried to kind of explain it to her. I was reassured when another woman came by and I told her, you know, oh, that's parental advisory section. And she said, oh, I was just talking with my daughter about GMOs and I don't care if she sees that one. So we got two sides of the coin. There's a lot of people who don't know, much about this issue at all. I have to admit, I didn't know a lot of the information that Howard shared in this interview. So it was great for me to hear, and I will play it for you. So here it is. This is Howard Vlieger talking about GMOs, followed by Ron Culley talking about I-522, the campaign in Washington.
Good morning. My name is Howard Vlieger. I'm a third-generation family farmer from Northwest Iowa. I have been studying and researching genetically engineered crops since 1994. That's begun when I began studying them. Started on-farm research in 1997, and I work with a range of very qualified scientists in their respective fields from around the world in doing research on the challenges and the problems associated with genetically engineered crops and the chemicals that are used in growing of those crops. And I was asked to come to Washington and give education presentations so that people could hear more of the story of what's happening actually at ground level with them, rather than some of the propaganda that is being promoted. They'll have an opportunity to see for themselves what we've seen from the soil up from day one.
Great. And I feel like at the forefront of that propaganda is this idea that, you know, what are you worried about? We've been genetically engineering crops for a long time through, you know, selective breeding and all of this to get the kind of tomatoes we want. That's the most common argument for GMOs, I hear. Why is that wrong?
Well, that's twofold. First of all, the hybrid development and the crossbreeding that has occurred for thousands of years, as they say, is completely unlike genetic modification in the sense of how they're doing it. Now, yes, we have been improving the genetics of these crops, and they have been changing and improving, but it's always been by a bisexual process in traditional plant breeding and crossbreeding. Genetic engineering is completely opposite of that. It is not the traditional process. They are taking species and genes from unlike species and crossing them. This would never occur in nature. So that's a very misleading statement that they are making when they try to confuse people into believing, well, we're just doing the same thing we've been doing forever.
Yeah, well, and people are so uneducated in general about food that it makes it really difficult to educate normal consumers. What has the reaction been from farmers when you work with other farmers and talk to them?
The genetically engineered crops had a very attractive persuasion because of the ease of farming and implementation for supposed less management with the in-plant insect protection and or the herbicide tolerance, so that we could manage weeds without multiple tools, whether it be tillage, a combination of different herbicides, or cultural practices. So that was a big draw from the farmer's standpoint for the genetically engineered. The farmer was not told the whole story. I'm fortunate to work with a number of very credible researchers from some of our land-grant universities that did the actual viable research that documented the significant challenges that are in place. The story that we're told that we need GMOs to feed the world because we're going to increase yield. There's zero proof of that. There's no documentation at our university level. In fact, just the opposite has been documented, that 93% of the time when they compare the original isoline to the genetically converted or genetically engineered version of that original isoline, the yield was less. And very few times did it increase. The on-farm research that we conducted on our farm in 1997 and 1998 documented that same fact. We lost money using a good, sound genetics in corn and using the BT version of it. Now, the seed company also had genetics that were not good sound agronomic hybrids, in which they inserted the BT into, and that worked. But what did you want to do? Did you want to have a good sound agronomic breeding program for developing your hybrids, or did you want to take a shortcut and use the short-term effects of the BT for protecting the plant against insects? And of course, today we have an ever-increasing number of insects that have developed resistance to the current technology for pest control, and the insect problems are more challenging than they have ever been before. The farmers are not only paying the extra cost for the technology seed, but they have a higher cost of insecticide than they've ever had before, because the insects are so resistant and their defense mechanisms are so solid, they have to use higher rates and stronger rates of insecticide in order to control them. And the same thing is happening on weeds. Everybody thought it was a scare tactic when they said, well, we're going to see the development of superweeds. I have seen the superweeds. I work with farmers that are dealing with the superweeds, and they are superweeds. Weeds that used to be 3 foot tall when they were fully matured and have 100,000 seeds on the plant, today can be 12 feet tall and have over 400,000 seeds per plant.
Wow.
And with the example of the amaranth pigweed in the southeast, I know of farmers who have spent $150 per acre to have the hand labor workers come in and remove that single weed from their cotton and peanut fields. Because if they don't spend that $150 an acre to have that weed removed, they won't have a crop. And the mode of action in which weeds die as a result of the use of glyphosate-based herbicides will continually cause a accelerated increase in the virulence of those weeds, just from the aspect of how it goes about killing a weed.
So basically, to oversimplify, the only people who really benefit from this are chemical companies who are making these ever stronger insecticides, herbicides?
In the long term, I don't believe that would be an inaccurate statement.
Yeah.
You know, there have been some short-term benefits for farmers that had the situations and the circumstances to manage it. But it's interesting now, when they arrive at this point, where one customer I have in Iowa, he sprayed a glyphosate-based herbicide 3 times on a field, soybean field this year, to try and kill the tall water hemp that he has in that field. And he did not kill it. It's all going to seed. They are trying to remove it by hand in a good portion of the field, whether or not they'll get it all, and they're not going to get it all because some of the seeds are already falling on the ground on the mature plants. But we will be using more of a total system management approach in managing those weeds, because the corn, soybeans, and pouring out of the jug and spray it days are not working anymore. And they're accepting, they're open to the ideas. A lot of them are, not everybody. They realize that things are changed. They don't necessarily know what is wrong, but in the extreme cases, what's wrong, in north central Iowa, there are farmers who have, with the buildup of the glyphosate residues in their soil, have experienced what you could call crop failures. When some people in the neighborhood are harvesting 220 to 250 bushels of corn, they have 100 to 125 bushels of corn in the same year. And those issues hit you real hard in the pocketbook. So when that happens, then they're looking for alternatives. And the mainstream approach of more chemical or more fertilizer is not solving their financial problems.
So at this point, I mean, that sounds fairly extreme with the super weeds and the super bugs. It sounds a little science fiction-ish. Is there a way to go back? I mean, is there a turning back from these changes that have taken place triggered by this genetic engineering, or is it about adapting to it at this point, ecosystem-wise?
Well, there's one saying that's where there's a will, there's a way. There are a ever-growing number of people that have recognized this problem and that are working on remediating these negative effects. Yes, it can be fixed. Depending on how quick it's fixed, would kind of like be answering a question, okay, I'm going to cut this log in half. Now, how big is the log, first of all? Well, how bad is the problem in the field? How long have we been operating in this continuous system to where we've been using the same herbicide approach for the development of this particular weed issue? So is it a 6-inch log or is it a 12-inch log? Now we've identified how bad the problem is. What tools are we going to implement to use? We have, to cut this log, we have a handsaw, we have a skill saw, and we have a chainsaw. So it's up to the individual to select which tool he wants to use and how fast he wants to fix his problem. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, the good part of it is it can be done without severe damage to their pocketbook. But the thing that they have to accept as, and this is kind of a rude awakening in some cases, they have followed the instruction and the guidance of, let's say, the industry that has promoted this technology, and they have worked with their local representatives that have implemented this and worked with them according to the guidance and the direction from the people up or down the chain that developed this. And the local people have, you know, they've been doing what they were told to do. Now, whether it was right or didn't have consequences, that's immaterial at this point in time. They were doing what they were told to do. But who has the problem? Is it the man at ground level that's making his living off of it? So, in essence, sometimes the first step has to be that they recognize this fact and they take back control, mm-hmm. and they take the decision-making factor back in their own hands, and they mm-hmm. take back the research, what options do we have out there approach. So they're not dependent mm-hmm. on somebody else. And they'll be in more of a long-term, in more of a sustainable structure for their best interests, mm-hmm. rather than sustaining the system that has promoted this type of farming method.
What are some of the consequences? I've heard a lot of stories at this point about, specifically about Monsanto with Roundup Ready seeds and everything. These are stories from a while back. But what are the consequences of reasserting your independence from the biotech industry and from this very powerful system that's already set up?
Well, I'm gonna answer your question in kind of a twofold approach. First of all, they have assumed all of the liability for the consequences. Whether they read the extremely fine print on the back side of the purchase agreement for the seed that had the genetically engineered characteristics, in the fine print wording on the back of that contract, they in effect take responsibility for any and all things that can happen negatively in regards to raising this crop the way they are told to do it by the developer. So they already own the problem. They have also given up, to some extent, their property rights. Because when they sign that technology agreement, depending on which company it is, and most of them are uniform in this approach, they give the holder of the patent of that seed the right to come on their property anytime they want, unannounced, without invitation, and you have no ability to prevent them from doing that. So that is already in place. The consequences hopefully won't come to fruition before we're able to remediate and mitigate the adverse effects that are left behind by the use of the technology. And there has to be a high level of attention paid to both the biological diversity in the soil, which is significantly damaged by glyphosate-based herbicides. That was denied for many years by the developer of glyphosate. But when they patented glyphosate as an antibiotic in 2010 with the U.S. Patent Office, it was a little difficult for them to deny that fact anymore, that glyphosate was having an adverse effect on organisms. And USDA scientists, researchers have documented significant adverse effects of glyphosate on beneficial organisms in the soil. When these beneficial organisms are damaged, that allows the opportunistic organisms to many times go unchecked. In a lot of cases, the beneficial organism will be the natural control mechanism for the opportunistic. When the opportunistic has no control, it's allowed free reign. But then in other instances, the glyphosate actually acts as a food source to further promote the growth of the opportunistic organisms. Well, when you have opportunistic organisms in the soil, you have an increase in plant diseases as a result of this imbalance between good and bad biological activity. So when there's more opportunistic organisms functioning and more plant disease, guess what the farmer has to do? He has an additional expense to try and keep that crop healthy, first of all, from a yield standpoint, and secondly, the thing that is being witnessed so vividly now in livestock is the nutrient deficiency aspects of the grain that's raised in the genetically engineered production system. And we've made the connection for the problems in the soil, the problems in the grain, the problems in the livestock. And sadly, we're seeing a spillover of these same problems in livestock now affecting our human population in our country. And they make the claim that, well, nobody's ever been hurt by a genetically engineered crop. They can get away with that because of the lack of identification of the genetically engineered crop. It's not possible to do the proper epidemiology that is necessary to determine what caused this when you don't know if it's genetically engineered or not, or if it contains glyphosate residue or not. There are no crops raised in a glyphosate production system that glyphosate residues have not been detected at significant and damaging levels. Glyphosate residues are also being detected in non-GMO crops, whether it's the residual uptake of the glyphosate residue by the crop that's raised in a no-till environment from a burn-down pre-plant application of glyphosate, or in some cases, they are using glyphosate-based herbicides now as ripening agents on a wide variety of crops. The crop is just about mature. Instead of letting the weather and nature take its course of finaling that maturation of the crop, they go out and spray it with a glyphosate-based herbicide. In 5 days, they can come in and harvest it. Well, guess what? That glyphosate herbicide doesn't vanish into thin air. Yeah. Some of it's in the stover of the crop. Some of it's in the grain of the crop. More of it is deposited into the soil. And it's very difficult to get rid of because of this antibiotic effect that it has, because we rely on organisms to digest chemical residue. Well, when you're damaging the beneficial organisms, how are you going to digest the residue that's left behind?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really just ruins the whole chain of how food is supposed to work going into your body, and the whole, it's supposed to be a cycle. And it really, I mean, the way you've described it, it sounds like a human body with an autoimmune disease or severe addiction or some combination of the two. What can you describe? So you've been doing an experiment for quite a while, raising pigs?
Well, the scientific study that I am the coordinator on the study and a co-author on the study was published in June of this year. And what we did was we had seen consistent problems in the feeding of genetically engineered crops from starting in 1998 with the first BT corn. We saw conception problems in the sows. The conception rates were down at varying degrees and levels depending on the type of BT corn that was being fed to the animals. And the BT would be out of the feed. There would not be a problem. Everything would be normal. They'd put the BT in the feed. Conception rates would drop anywhere from 30 to 70%, depending on the type of BT. Another BT corn in South Dakota, the conception rates dropped 1.6 pigs litter per litter, as well as the size and the weight of the pig when they were born was smaller. In western Iowa, central western Iowa, there was something called pseudopregnancies. The one farmer had the problem that his sows would appear to conceive and be bred, and they'd go full term, and they'd just deliver a little sack of water and the afterbirth. And that article, his problem was actually written up in the Farm Bureau Spokesman magazine. And when that problem came out in the magazine, he started getting phone calls from at least a half a dozen farmers in the surrounding counties. And there was a common denominator. They had all planted and raised the same BT corn and were feeding it to their hogs, and they were all having that same problem with pseudopregnancies. But the people at the state level couldn't seem to draw a conclusion and make a connection between the use of that BT corn and the pseudopregnancies. But when they quit using that BT corn, the problem went away. We saw consistency in the digestive problems. Ileitis, salmonella, bloody bowel, and ulcers were predominantly present in pigs that died for whatever reason in the growing and finishing stages. So as a result of this, we had been collecting, and we called it anecdotal evidence. Well, I learned later that we actually conducted Koch's postulates, which is one step in a scientific study, by putting the genetically engineered feed in the ration, taking it away, putting it in, taking it away. We put it in, the problem came, we took it away, the problem stopped. That, coupled with the tour of a hog slaughter plant that I took way back when, I don't remember the exact year, I saw the consistency of the damage in the digestive system when we took that tour. And they graciously allowed me to come back on a number of occasions and take pictures of hog stomachs that were on different feeding programs. And the evidence was very, the evidence was very damning towards the genetically engineered crop. The irritation, inflammation, and ulcerations that were present when anecdotally, we didn't have scientific proof that these animals were on GE because it wasn't in a controlled setting, but when 75-80% of the corn was genetically engineered and 85-90% of the soybeans were genetically engineered, it was pretty safe to presume that what they were eating. So we thankfully, I was introduced by a mutual acquaintance to Dr. Carmen, and we set up the protocol for the study. We fed the pigs the genetically engineered corn and soy and the non-GMO corn and soy from the day they were weaned off of their mother, so that all the solid food they consumed, up until the day they were marketed and harvested for meat. Qualified licensed practicing veterinaries do a full autopsy on all of the organs of all these animals, and the two statistically sound scientific results that came out of that study. Number one, the uterine weight of the pigs, the females fed the genetically engineered grain, was 25% higher than the normal uterine weight of the non-GM fed. Now that didn't the study wasn't designed in a manner to do the follow-up histology on that, but that was a significant red flag that came up that said, hey, this is not normal. And future research needs to be conducted to find out How does that correlate into the adverse effects we're seeing with some of the genetically engineered crops as far as conception mm-hmm. rates or spontaneous abortions, which are very prevalent in a wide species of livestock? The other significant finding was the pigs that were fed the GM corn and soy were 2.6 times more likely to have severe inflammation in their stomachs. For the males, they were 4 times more likely, and the females were 2.2 times more likely. That was the primary issue that we saw consistently, was what's going wrong in the digestive tract. And they say we have no problems in the human population as a result of genetically engineered crops. Mm-hmm. As I said, they can get away with that because there's no ability to identify it. But why is there such a tremendous increase in the inflammation and digestive issues and the good microflora in the gut of all of the, first of all, our children, and mm-hmm. secondly, the adult population, and what does that lead to? 70 to 80% of the immune system is located in the digestive tract. Mm-hmm. How many increasing immune system diseases are we experiencing in our country? So that's part of wow. of the view from where I stand, I guess.
Wow. So what has the reception been so far in Washington on your tour, and what's the main purpose of coming here to do a tour?
The tour is just beginning. The first presentation that I did was a very small setting last night. And the reaction was, wow, I didn't know that. And there's way more to this than what I realized. The purpose of the tour is simple. This is about education. I'm not here to tell anybody how to vote. I'm here to present the experiences and the evidence that we have accumulated at ground level, you might say on the front line. Whether or not everyone is seeing it, or some are seeing it and identifying and recognizing what it is, that's an issue you could debate all day long. But there's an ever-growing number of people that know something's wrong. Some are classifying it as normal, because when it happens to everyone, what do you call it, normal?
Yeah.
Thankfully, there are enough people that realize that's not the case. It is not normal. And that's the purpose of why I'm here, is to share this information, give the education presentations, and hopefully enable the people to become more interested in what's going on with their food. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there is an expression, you are what you eat.
That's true. So it looks like Friday, tomorrow, September 6th, we'll have this online by then, at the Mason Jar in Cheney, Washington, from 10 a.m. to noon, and then at the Burbank Grange in Burbank from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., and then Saturday back in Spokane at the Moran County Library, which is up on South Regal, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. again, and then Sunday in Ellensburg, the Teenaway Room at the Hal Holmes Community Center, from 2 to 3:30, and Chelan, and then after that, the Chelan County PUD Auditorium in Wenatchee, 6:30 to 8:30. That's a jam-packed weekend for you. But Ron, do you want to talk a little bit about I-522 and what?
Sure.
And just same thing, just introduce yourself and how you got involved.
All right. I'm Ron Cully, and I got interested in genetically engineered foods about 4 years ago, and discovered that there was a lot of things that the general public just didn't seem to know. And I felt like this is a pretty important area for people to be able to decide for themselves what they're putting into their bodies and feeding their families. And when I-522 came out, I became a big supporter of that. I-522 is an initiative that was created by the people of Washington. It had more signatures than just about any other initiative that's been presented for placement on the ballot, and it just goes to show that the public is very interested in this area as well. The issues are not so much about whether things are safe or not safe, although that's a big point behind why people are interested. The key issue is whether or not we have the right to decide what we buy, because we have the ability to know what's in our food when we pick it up off the store shelf. That's what this is all about. And it's just a simple label, goes on the package, it tells whether it's genetically engineered or not. And that way, people who want to avoid it have the ability to shop from the 20 to 30% of non-genetically engineered products that are on the shelves today, where the companies can't afford to go off and do the certification processes for either organic or for non-GMO verified. And that way it'll keep the food cost down. The label's really, really cheap. There's nothing that they have to do special except put a few words on a label, on a box, that is that they're already going to be modifying anyway. I mean, as an example, Wheaties has changed their box over 300 times in the last 30 years. And so, you know, you're looking at, lots and lots of changes out there. Mm-hmm. So they can just add these words to their box, and that's all it means.
I would think that would do a lot towards education when people realize that 80%, 70 to 80% of the products are genetically engineered or derivatives from those. And I think that would help. Do you think that would help spark?
Yeah. You know, when I first discovered these existed, we were at this massive level of presence in the market. And I was like, well, how did this happen? How is it that we could make such a fundamental change in our food system and the public not know? And anybody who eats food should go and understand what's going on here, because this is serious. This is not, it's not what we've been led to believe. And I want the ability to be able to opt out of an experiment, because there's been no long-term studies. The longest long-term studies that they're done by the industry are only about 90 days long. And the issues that Howard is seeing, these things don't show up until 4 to 7 months into the cycle of feeding these animals. So we don't have any long-term studies that show that there are not ill effects here. And the other part of the problem is that the FDA, the USDA, the EPA, they do not do any testing of these at all. They rely exclusively on the summary results that are produced by the creators of genetically engineered crops. And
nothing could go wrong, right?
Of course. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that the studies that they produce, the FDA even has it on their website in their guidelines to the producers of this technology: we won't look at your data. It says it right there. We will not look at your data. We will only look at the summary report information that you provide to us. Further, the data doesn't have to be released to the general public for open peer review. It's peer reviewed only by people that they paid because of the intellectual property rights that they have behind those technologies. And so if I was, you know, these guys make billions of dollars on these seeds and chemicals. And so the question in my mind is, man, if I have know that no one's going to look at my data and I get to say whether it's safe or not, could I just throw away some stuff? Could I trim the studies back and only do 90 days when I know that there's serious health consequences at 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 months?
Wow, that's insane. And what do you think, so you've been involved in the campaign, what do you think the chances are for passing this in Washington?
I'm really optimistic. We have a majority of the voters that want this. The big question is whether people are going to listen to the propaganda that comes out. In California, there were 4 companies and 1 organization that produced the lion's share of the funding against the proposition there. And it was the 4 chemical companies: Monsanto, Dow, Bayer, and Syngenta. Then they had the Grocery Manufacturers Association. They put $45 million out and spending on advertising in the last couple weeks of the election. And the yes side, the grassroots that had raised $7 million, didn't have enough money to respond to the propaganda. So the question is whether you're going to believe the hyperbole that they give about this stuff being safe and that it's going to drive your food costs up. Mm-hmm. Now, in Washington, we have a rich history of doing labeling for people to have a right to know, and it has not changed our food prices. back in 1957, we had grown in Washington chickens, and there was a label on all the chickens that were grown in Washington. It was a mandated law that if you grew chickens in Washington, you must put this label on it. In 2002, we had a law that was the origin of fruits and vegetables, and every single fruit and vegetable in the state of Washington had to be labeled that it was grown in Washington. And every single fruit and vegetable grown in the U.S., not in Washington, had to say grown in the U.S. And that has not affected our fruit and vegetable costs. So there's no excuse whatsoever that this labeling law will increase food prices.
I feel like it has a strong appeal to pretty much anyone. I mean, you have your environmentalists in Washington, people who are really pro-organic in that camp who are going to be kind of automatic supporters. But I think it's smart to focus on this idea of autonomy and, you know, controlling your own body and keeping your family safe. And we have farmers here still, unlike some states, you know, we still have a farming industry, and I think people will understand. So
yeah,
I hope that it goes well. What do you need as the campaign right now from people?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is for people to be talking about this. That's one huge part of it. Just the awareness that there's an issue out here and people need to get educated. And there are some places that you can go to get educated. On Howard's tour, there's a site that's facebook.com/GMO crop education. That's one place you can go this week to learn a lot of information. I have a blog site called letmedecide.org. And there's another Facebook page that here in Spokane that's facebook.com/GMO label Spokane. So those are good starting points. There's a lot of other sites, but get educated. The second thing is that if you feel passion around this, we need money. We're going to have the same big money bags being dropped in Washington. They dropped in $2.5 million between, I think it was around the 25th of August and about the 30th of August, somewhere around that time frame. They dumped in an additional $2.5 million to fight against this initiative that came strictly from those five organizations. There's not a single other donator to the no side. It's all coming from multinational outside interests. There's not a single farmer, individual identifiable farmer, who has signed on as a partner on that. It's all the 20 different branches of the Farm Bureau, not the individual farmers that are saying this. And if you look at the yes side, we've got 109 individual farmers who have signed on and said that they want to support this.
Mm-hmm. I saw something posted on the GMO Label Spokane Facebook page today that the money you've raised has been something like 85% from within Washington. It's smaller donations.
Well, it's not quite. It's the number of donations have been dominantly from Washington. From the dollar value perspective, about a third of it comes from within inside of the state of Washington. We've got about 8 companies that have contributed over $50,000. We've got about 29 others that have contributed over $10,000. And there's been over 1,400 individuals who've contributed about $900,000 to the campaign.
Wow.
And those numbers are going to go up when we report on the 10th. We have over 5,000 contributions, with the lion's share of that coming from individuals in the state of Washington, not big corporate interests. We're talking about individuals that are caring about their families and contributing the $10, $20 types of donations that they can afford.
Great. And I just got passed over to me a note, another thing to keep in mind with this: the same companies that make food products here in the U.S. make the same products without GMO ingredients for 64 other countries of the world.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Great example of this. We've got a picture of a Cake Mate frosting can that was purchased in Australia, and it lists all of the genetically engineered ingredients down the side of the can. That same brand of frosting, it's packaged by McCormick, packaged and shipped over there with a label. And over here in the U.S., it's packaged without the information on it. So we're getting the same thing, and they're producing two labels. So there's no reason they can't do this. And some of the companies are saying, well, if we do this in Washington, we have to have two labels, and it's going to be expensive. And I have a question. Why do they need two labels? They could do just one label, but they don't want to, because they don't want the rest of the people to know, because they think what they know will happen is the same thing as happened in Europe. In Europe, they have labeling laws, and there is no market for genetically engineered food. And so they're going to lose their market share because the people who are producing the non-genetically engineered food, people will gravitate to those products, and will the free market economy will show that non-genetically engineered food is favored. And they know that, and they're afraid of it, and they're trying to block the free market economy from working by blinding the consumer.
And meanwhile, you have cases like, I read, this was probably 3 years ago now, after the earthquake in Haiti, where they attempted to donate a bunch of genetically engineered seed, and they burnt it all. They gathered it all up in the center of town and just set it on fire and said, no, thank you.
Yeah, there's nothing that says that people care more than when they're willing to burn food when they're starving.
So that's, so that's on the, you know, it's kind of too late for that here because of the contamination and everything, but it's good that people are doing something about it. So is there anything else that either of you want to add just in the last couple of minutes that we have?
We just would like to have people come out and hear what Howard has to say. You know, whether you believe labeling is good or bad, just get informed. I mean, hearing the information that Howard has, I've been studying this for 3-4 years. I was completely blown away by what he had to say. I was just stunned, almost speechless in terms of the things that I learned in the time that I've spent with Howard. So you don't want to miss this.
Great. Thank you so much for getting in touch with me and doing the interview. So that was Ron Culley, and before him, Howard Villiger, both anti-GMO activists, or pro-informational activists, I suppose, if we're going to frame it in that sense. Interviewed both of them on Thursday, the 5th, this last week. I put it up as a podcast, but liked it so much, thought I'd broadcast it. And it's pretty interesting to listen to that, especially after, if you're a regular listener to the show, these last 2 weeks before today, talking with Elf and Margaret from Bruce Rule Design, talking about permaculture and just a completely different way to do things. And with this GMO argument, it's like as though industrial agriculture weren't bad enough, and as if monocropping, you know, just planting wheat for miles and miles and miles, or soy or corn or even hemp, which I, you know, love for other reasons, and I think it could be a good solution, but people, you know, who want to do industrial scale hemp production kind of overlook the problems with growing one crop in an area, as if that weren't bad enough for the soil and for biological diversity and for, you know, continuation of life on the planet, we're going to make genetically engineered monocrops that result in the kind of problems that Howard talked about at the beginning, the super bugs, the super weeds. The other thing that struck me listening to that over again is this, it's a real pattern with humans thinking that we can improve upon nature's systems that already work. They worked well enough to create us, you know, that's how evolution happened, and thinking that we can improve them and having these incredible backfiring moments, like, you know, drug-resistant diseases in humans, and just really intense, I mean, cancer being created by all these modern diseases that we're pouring money into finding a cure for, when really the cure is don't pollute the environment in ways that are toxic to humans. So labeling these, I think, is one step toward getting people educated and really thinking about, well, why would we, you know, use all these chemicals and create stronger pests, what you want to call pests, if you're trying to grow one thing that used to be part of a functional system. So very interesting stuff. Again, those websites, and I'm going to read something off of one. LetMeDecide.org is Ron's blog that he keeps for the labeling campaign for 522. And then on Facebook, the GMO Label Spokane. I'll share that on my show page, which is facebook.com/praxisradio. All of that information will be available there. And yeah, hopefully we can get this figured out and start moving towards a better way of doing things. So Ron alluded to the money, you know, where's the money coming from as far as the opposition goes. I just saw a post on his blog that, let's see, we can look at the cash contributions. He says, this is from his website, letmedecide.org, the storm is gathering against 522 as the opposition has begun to declare donations to their campaign fight. I'm sure this is just the beginning, and if California, meaning California's labeling initiative last year, was any indication, we'll likely see this amount grow 20 to 40 times as big in the next few months. What is interesting to look at is the list of opponents. Monsanto, $242,000. DuPont Pioneer, $171,000. Bayer Crop Science, $29,000. Dow AgroSciences, $29,000. And the Grocery Manufacturers Association, $472,000. Actually, what is interesting is the lack of citizens behind the opposition. There are none. Yes, it's only the seed and chemical companies that make billions sneaking their toxic crops into the food system while keeping you in the dark, and the food packagers who don't want their toxic foods to be exposed because they will lose market share to non-GMO products if they have to tell you the truth. No consumers here shouting, by God, give me more GMO foods, and please don't tell me that I'm eating them. So, I mean, yet again, we see that you can't really have democracy in a functional way if you also have corporate crony capitalism. Sorry, folks, it's just not going to happen. So this also ties in really well with what I'm going to talk about next week, if all goes to plan. I'm a little behind, but I've just been trying to assemble the right interviews and get the right people scheduled. But we saw that in court, the decisions to block the two initiatives, the Community Bill of Rights and the Clean and Fair Elections Act, from the local ballot by the city council and other entities was held up in court. Those will not be on the ballot, even though they passed the entire initiative process to get them there. So that's kind of a red flag for people, because this, you know, this GMO labeling initiative, other initiatives at the state level, it's the same type of process, just at the higher level. And that's really the only way that people can, it's the closest, the initiative system and process is really the closest to direct democracy people are allowed to get within the system that we have today. You know, direct democracy would be my choice for a system set up. It would have to be much smaller than what we have. Federal government is very unwieldy. State government is very unwieldy. And our local government is apparently tied in to the extent with, you know, this corporate-controlled behemoth that they will strike down initiatives that have qualified for the ballot by citizens. So that has really broad implications that we'll be able to look at next week. And we'll see what happens. It'll be really interesting. But so both Envision Spokane's initiative, the Community Bill of Rights, and SMAC's initiative, Clean and Fair Elections Act, were about getting corporate money out of elections. And why is that a problem? Because in this case with 522, you know, you get Monsanto, DuPont, Bayer, Dow, and the Grocery Manufacturers Association pouring what is sure to be tens of millions of dollars into a propaganda campaign to keep people in the dark about what they're consuming. For no reason other than they'll continue to make money if people don't know what's going on. And they'll do things like they generally do, like create ads that say it's good for farmers, and they'll rustle up some person to take a picture in a cowboy hat in a field, you know, talking about how without these crops he couldn't make any money and things like that. So that brings us to lies that the opponents are recycling in Washington State. This is a handy advice from some folks in California who already went through this GMO labeling issue in recent years. And this is on the Organic Consumers Association website, and it's by Zach Caldevere. He says, it's deja vu all over again. Last year, a coalition of out-of-state, multinational biotech, pesticide, and junk food corporations spent nearly $46 million to narrowly defeat Proposition 37, California's GMO labeling initiative. Now the same who's who of the world's most notorious global corporate bad actors has descended on Washington State. Why? To try to stop Washington State voters from passing 522, a citizens' initiative that, if passed, will require mandatory labeling of genetically modified organisms in all food products sold in Washington State. Like bad robots, they're spitting out the same old tired lies designed to scare voters into voting against their best interests. Here are the lies and the facts. Please read, print, email, roll up, and stuff into a bottle you launch into the sea. Whatever it takes to spread the word that while 46 million may buy a lot of lies, it doesn't change the facts. First lie, labeling genetically engineered foods will cost taxpayers millions of dollars a year. Truth, empirical studies have concluded labeling would lead to no increases in prices. Since the EU labeled GMOs in the 1990s, that's great guys, 20 years ago, there has been no resulting increase in grocery costs. Trader Joe's, Clif Bar & Co., and Washington's own PCC Natural Markets all label their non-GMO product lines at no additional cost to consumers. Second lie, I-522 is full of arbitrary special interest exemptions that will just confuse consumers. Truth, 522 requires labeling for the GE foods that are most prevalent in the American diet, food on supermarket shelves. 522's exemptions are easy to explain and guided by common sense and the law. They are restaurants. Restaurants and bake sales are not required to list the ingredients in their products. Meat, cheese, dairy, and eggs from animals will be labeled if they come from genetically engineered animals. However, they're exempt if the animals ate genetically engineered feed, but they are not themselves genetically engineered. The exemption is common around the world. It doesn't make sense for Washington's law to be stricter than international standards. And alcohol. Alcohol labeling is regulated under different laws than food at both the federal and state levels. So alcohol can't be included because of the single subject law. Next lie, consumers don't need labels to avoid GMOs. All they need to do is buy certified organic products. Truth, food companies routinely and intentionally mislead consumers by labeling products natural in order to attract health-conscious consumers. Because the U.S. FDA does not prohibit the use of the word natural on products containing GMOs, most consumers are fooled by this label. According to a recent poll by the Hartman Group, 61% of respondents erroneously believe that the use of the word natural implies or suggests the absence of GMOs, versus 63% who correctly believe that the label organic means that a product is GMO-free. Food companies should be required, as they are in some 60 other countries, to clearly state that a product contains GMOs. If companies truly believe their GMO ingredients are perfectly safe, why spend millions to keep from having to label them? So... oh, and the next one, there's quite a few of these, but I like this one. Washington will be the only state in the nation to label GMOs, unfairly hurting farmers in the state's multi-billion dollar agricultural industry. This is probably one we'll hear a lot of, and we'll see those farmer actors in the ads from these chemical companies. Truth, Washington won't be the only state labeling GE foods. Connecticut, Maine, and Alaska have passed labeling laws, and dozens of other states are considering identical proposals. Besides, 64 countries already require labeling, so many farmers are already used to labeling for exports. In fact, many Washington farmers support labeling because they believe that growing GMO crops destroys healthy soil, and because they sell crops to overseas markets that either require labels on GMO crops or ban them completely, these countries are increasingly concerned about U.S. non-GMO crops, such as wheat, that could be potentially contaminated by cross-pollination with GMO crops. So, lots of reasons. The thing I always notice is if you listen to the show, you know that I don't really have positive feelings about the state as an entity in general, but it's just so frustrating that the justification so often used by these corporations, this powerful elite, you know, and the state, that these consumers, these people just don't know how to do much of anything, and will confuse them because they're not very smart, and, you know, all they care about is if they're going to have to spend more money. So we're going to tell them that. And it's sad because apparently it works, because in California, this was beaten. So at least 51% of people who voted were fooled by that propaganda. But it's like a self-reinforcing cycle of telling people that they're too dumb to decide for themselves, and then destroying, you know, having an education system that really doesn't provide any critical thinking tools, and a media that takes advantage of people with no critical thinking tools. So all of those kind of create a perfect storm of, you know, idiocy, unfortunately, that leads to all kinds of problems. So remember your critical thinking hat. And there's a lot of good information, both through this letmedecide.org, through Facebook. You can find GMO labeling Spokane and get involved with that I-522 campaign. The important thing that I almost forgot to share, Ben and Jerry's ice cream is actually a really big supporter of GMO labeling, and they are the downtown location, River Park Square on Main and Post, is having a press conference and rally of some kind. They're encouraging to bring signs on Facebook. I'll share that information too. And that will be at 3:30 p.m. today, Monday, September 9th. So if you want to see some people locally working on this and see what Ben and Jerry's has to say and see what some of these other folks that will be there have to say, that's going on. 3:30 p.m. at the Ben and Jerry's downtown. So that's just about it for the show today. That was a great interview. I want to thank Howard Villiger and Ron Culley for getting in touch with me to do that. And like I said at the top of the hour, KYRS's 10th birthday, so do send us a birthday card. If you think of it, check the Facebook for information or just mail it to 35 West Main, Spokane, Washington, 99201. Address it to KYRS and it will make its way up here. I don't know the suite number. I probably should. And as you also may know, Spokane's music scene and just community lost a superhero this last week. Sam Jordan, rest in peace, dude. He was a great person. When I met Sam, I just turned 19 and I didn't know how to do anything. And I was putting on my first art show and I was really nervous about finding jurors. And I was nervous to contact him because he was, you know, such a big deal. And I met him and he pretty much told me, you know, I'm just a person. You can call anyone anytime you want because they're just other people. So really appreciate that he was able to teach me that. Inspired a lot of people and he'll be missed. So this one goes out to you. And everybody have a great day. I'll be back next week. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.